Hey guys, welcome back. BeautyCKR here. We're back with our weekly Q&A content. It's a YouTube video. It's a podcast. If you're on YouTube, the links are in the description to get this on a bunch of different podcasting platforms. Mm-hmm. And if you're on the podcast, I'm sure you already know about our YouTube. So I won't even tell you about it. You'll just have to find it yourself. If you're like the one person that somehow has stumbled your way into the podcast.
And never found our YouTube channel.
That's true.
Because there was somebody apparently who stumbled onto our podcast. And
well, yeah, when we first said that, one person was like, yeah, actually somebody recommended me the podcast first. Yeah. And so I didn't know you had a YouTube channel until you told me. But I think it was just one person once. So
Yeah. So this is season 11. And I like to call this the season of the Lost Challenge characters. And so this season, we've been starting with a little bit of a talk, sort of in between. Like, we used to do some multiplayer videos and going into more details and commentary on the fights and just aspects of it. We've gotten away from that, but we're doing this a little bit now for all the challenge characters that have not had a challenge season since May 2020. Mm-hmm. So it could have been even further before that. This week, we are looking at Regime Raven. Her passive is Demon Stance. Once per match, when Raven is at 40% health or less, her basic attacks drain power from the opponent for 6 seconds. She's got 950 attack and 950 health.
Yeah.
So, she's got really super low stats for a challenge character. I don't think she was even that great when she came out. You look at her passive. So, what's funny is, you can really tell that she's an old character, that she came out a long time ago, by how bad her passive is. Mm-hmm. It's got one ability. It lasts 8 seconds of an entire fight.
It's not a good ability even, really.
No, because if you can only get it when your health is low, then for a large part of the fight, you're going to be not having the ability.
Yeah.
And then you'll have it for a few moments when you're in mortal danger.
And also, just because of how, you know, damage works, a lot of the times the thing that's going to bring you down to that level is somebody using a special against you.
Yeah.
So there's not going to be anything for you to drain from them
right,
after that.
Right. So that ability is not powerful enough and not consistent enough over the course of a fight to plan your fight strategy around it. You're almost better off or as good as somebody who doesn't have a passive that you might want to choose to rely on, hope that makes a difference. It's not going to make a difference.
Yeah.
It's an unpleasant surprise even, and makes it worse if that passive happens to trigger against an opponent with two pieces of Lex Core gears. Mm-hmm. 'Cause then all of a sudden you're giving them power, which is bleh. So what makes her even worse? So usually when characters have a not helpful passive, you know what makes up for it? Mm. Having good basic attacks, having really good specials. She does not have good specials. So the special that we typically look at with this team, where we've got Rebirth Raven and Hawk Girl, and we do a gear loadout on the sort of highlighted character with Tantu Totem and Master's Death Cart, and then sticking a third gear, depending on who we're playing with, that seems the most appropriate. In this case, it's Claw of Horus.
Yeah.
So we're using her as our special specialist, which in the current meta is what matters, and that's how you use somebody as a star, because then that's the biggest damage output. And there are some characters who may not have great passive, but their basic attacks, or more importantly, their specials, redeem them. That is not what happens here. Regime Raven's special 2 is not ranged. If it has any range, it's so tiny that Master's Death Cart is more than enough to shove them out of the way. And it shoves them out of the way fast enough that even if you are ready with two bars of power the minute you launch, and even if you don't need Master's Death Cart to give you the second bar of power, when you launch a special 2, that shoves them away far enough that it doesn't hit. Mm-hmm. It looks like it's not ranged at all. Special 1 even looks like it has longer range than special 2. Mm. So you can tag in, do a special 1, and have it land. You tag in, do special 2, it will not land when you've got Master's Death Card.
Yeah.
I will also say part of what's influencing me, too, is that I am not a big fan of the swipe minigame where you want to, you know, to get from 100% to 200% damage for your special, especially when each swipe is only 5%. I don't say this often enough about how much I enjoy a character more when they have either the tap minigame or even just the, you know, that sliding thing where you're supposed to aim it. I don't get 100% on the sliding thing most of the time anyways, but it's easier. It's low stress. You just tap it. It's fast. You're done. So you don't get 200%. If you've planned your team well enough, it should be good enough that it doesn't matter the same way.
Yeah.
What else? Special 2 has 3 hits. The good, any of those 3 hits can knock out the opponent. The bad, the timing on the 2nd and 3rd hits are so tight that even if you knock out the opponent on the first hit, the opponent tagging in generally will not take any damage. So you knock them out with the first hit, the next opponent tags in, and both hits are so fast, they miss.
So it might as well not actually knock them out on the first hit.
Right. Well, I guess almost. Yes and no. It's the one thing that it still helps with is that the animation of the 2nd and 3rd hits, even though they don't land, still protects you against tag-in effects.
That's true.
And what's weird is, I was going to say that's true all the time, that the 2nd and 3rd hits miss, but I had one fight, and I don't know what was different about this one fight. The 3rd hit landed.
Okay.
So it was weird, and I wonder if it was because the opponent was blocking, because it didn't hit them properly. It hit them and did like a little tiny, teeny bit of damage.
Interesting. Maybe.
So, despite the nostalgia sort of, what's the word I'm looking for? The nostalgia?
Value?
Yeah, value of Regine Raven. Because I think she's one of the earliest Android challenge characters.
She's one of the early ones, for sure.
She was one of the early ones. And, I mean, back then, when getting a free gold character was amazing.
Yeah.
I think there's at least that sort of aura of... I don't know, value, aura of specialness, I guess.
Well, the best gold character is the one that you have, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Oh, they say that. All right, so they say that in sports. The best ability is availability. Because no matter how good you are, I mean, that's, I'm watching, so I'm a big fan of baseball and basketball, but baseball's the first sport that I actually enjoyed watching, is that you see this argument all the time about how this player... if they'd stayed healthy, would be in the Hall of Fame, or if they didn't lose all these time, but that's part of the whole thing. Because when you look at the level of performance, you can't separate the fact that they do better because they push themselves to the limit. And when you push yourself to the limit, it's finding that edge where you push yourself enough to perform, but not so
enough
far
to hurt yourself.
Exactly. Yeah.
Because that's the thing with like professional athletes, when you're like Olympic level or like professional level, for when you're like the major leagues, right? You are pushing yourself hard enough that people, you know, in normal activity aren't supposed to hit that level. So most of them inevitably are sort of hurting themselves in one way or the other in terms of their long-term physical health, right? There's this sort of big bombastic injuries of like, you know, if you're a fighter getting like a brain injury or like breaking a bone or something like that, right? Something that like really takes you out. But your long-term for a lot of those sports has some amount of sort of injury intrinsic in it, even if there's no sort of one moment where, you know, oh, you tore your hamstring or whatever.
So I was watching something interesting. It was a video, a YouTube video actually, about Ronald Acuña Jr., who was he the MVP last year? He might have been, where he had the first, I believe, 40 home runs, 70 stolen base season ever. He created new categories for himself as an achievement. So what they were talking about was how early on in his career, he added, you know, there's newer metrics used in baseball that were that are different than the old counting metrics where you say, you know, how many RBIs, how many hits, how many whatever.
Yeah.
They're trying to quantify something that's previously difficult to quantify, which is defensive ability.
Mm.
And how Ronald Acuña Jr. used to contribute more defensively, that he had wins above replacement. It's a calculation that people do to take into account different stats and different things to try to evaluate the total ability of a player. Mm-hmm. So there's offensive, the batting war, and defensive war. And in the first few seasons, he had a really good positive defensive war, too, in addition to his offensive war. And then he hurt himself. And then when he came back from injury, his defensive contribution seemed to drop off. And it makes a lot of sense because, I mean, he hurt himself defensively. And because it's so much harder to quantify and so much harder to value, I think it's undervalued by both fans and professionals. But more importantly, if that's the place where you're more likely to hurt yourself, it feels like it makes a lot more sense. So you could have a lot of dramatic plays and a lot of, you know, risky dives and stuff.
Yeah.
But if it's going to cost you the season, so he lost a bunch of time. And so he's got a contemporary, I think it's Juan Soto, who's with the Yankees now. And they both came into the majors around the same time. Either that or they both had about as much. I think they came around the same time. But Juan Soto has comparable stats, but in a per game sort of style, like in the rate stats, he's not as good. But the biggest difference is he wasn't injured as much as Ronald Acuña Jr. So you can make the argument that, yeah, sure, Ronald Acuña Jr. is a better player. But if you're a team paying somebody millions of dollars, what are you getting at the end of the day for that spot? I would say that, again, that is such a ridiculous and true statement, is the best ability is availability.
Yeah. You know, when people talk about baseball, I don't watch it. My main connection is, you know, Moneyball and that kind of.
Oh, like, yeah.
But there was a funny tweet. It's not that new, where people were doing Moneyball style discussions of other stuff. And so the one that stuck with me is they were talking about, it was Lord of the Rings Moneyball.
Right.
And it was like, oh, well, if we, you know, get the birds, then they'll just bring the birds, they'll bring the ring straight to Mordor right away. It goes, no, we can't afford the birds, but what we can get is seven hobbits and we'll make up the birds in aggregate.
That's funny.
Or like, it's the same impact. We'll get them in aggregate.
I feel like that the one thing that seems to be missed about Moneyball isn't just being cheap.
Yeah.
Which is what I hear a lot about, right? Because Oakland had such low budgets and they were able to do so much. I think the key, it's sort of the idea of arbitrage, where you take something that is a little bit undervalued compared to what you could sell it for and make a profit based on that difference.
Yeah.
And what Moneyball, to me, Moneyball, I mean, it's easy to lose sight of it because it says Moneyball, right? It's about money. It's not.
Yeah.
It's about finding something that is undervalued and leaning into it. So it was a stat on base percentage that at the time that was not recognized as being valuable.
It's true.
And so they wouldn't spend money just because somebody had good high on base percentage, because if they had other high stats too, they would be valued appropriately. It was that people who were not so good at regular stuff but happened to have this one area that they did really well.
Moneyball is also a great dad movie because it appeals to, I think, something that is that a lot of dads really like, where it's the cool guy is the guy who's really into sports, but in the nerd way, right?
Oh, like an observer instead of like a participant.
It's like how like National Treasure or whatever, like the guy is like a scientist, right? When it's like the perfect dad movie, which is what things are dads into? They're into sports. They're into history. What are they? Well, they're people who like to do a lot of sort of armchair opinionation, right? They like to give other people their takes on stuff. So you want somebody who's a little nerdy, who's into something, and they need to be somehow the action hero or whatever. They need to be thrown into the thick of the things that dads are into, where it both needs to be their interest, but also a role that they could see themselves in. And so I think Moneyball really appeals to that, because it's like, oh, yeah, the cool guy, the main guy in the story, the one that we really care about and are rooting for, is the guy who's got a lot of opinions about baseball, and he gets really into the numbers of it.
I hadn't thought about it like that, but it feels so true when you say it.
Yeah, and it's I don't say that to mean it's a bad thing, right?
Right.
You know, I think that's very smart demographically. They almost did a Moneyball on their demographics for the movie. They said, who has money to spend? Who's got maybe some time to watch media? If you think about who's kicking back and watching a movie, it's dads. What are they into? Well, they're very into sports. Yeah. So how do we found an undervalued segment. How do we maximize our return on investment?
Funny. Yeah. That would actually be funnier if they'd had that discussion. We're making it up, right? Like you're making it, but it would be so much better if they'd actually done that.
As part of the movie?
Well, I don't know. It's one of those, you know, at the end of the movie when they show you the pictures of the real people?
Yeah.
It would have been funny if they'd gone and continued with the real people and showed the people producing the movie and having a discussion at the round table saying, you know what we need to do? You know what's really undervalued as a...
They should have done a second smaller Moneyball featuring the ad execs and producers who created the piece of content. Yeah. And to be fair, I mean, I watched it. I don't know how old I was like 14, 15 or something when I watched Moneyball. I liked the movie. So, you know, it's not like it's for dads only.
Right.
But I think if you think about what a perfect movie for dads, right? You know, I think another one that's kind of like that is like Field of Dreams.
Oh, it's another baseball.
But it's the same thing. It's sports and it's somebody has...
It's nostalgia, it's feeling,
it's sports emotions. And nostalgia, but it's a random guy has a home improvement project that is related to his interest in baseball, that for some reason becomes super, super important, and it puts him at the center of something really cool. Or it goes, he's got a useless project that to an outside observer wouldn't make a lot of sense. It's just him sort of doing something. And I think that's also a very dad thing, right? He's got his little project that nobody else would really understand or appreciate.
So one thing that's funny to me about movies, like talking about the demographics and stuff and trying to drive eyeballs or bums into seats at theaters.
Yeah.
In the old days, what used to make a successful movie was the kind of movie that people would want to see over and over and over again in the theater. So typically that would be spectacles. Typically that would be movies that appealed to really teenagers, like people who had the time to go back and see a movie over and over again, but they had to be old enough to have the money to be able to see it.
Mm-hmm.
So what's interesting to me is it's still less so with movies than say other things like books, but that sometimes it's harder to find a broadly appealing movie that becomes like a blockbuster hit than it is to really milk that niche that you've got. Like, I think Field of Dreams probably did not appeal to so many people that they wanted to see it over and over again, although there's probably a small market that did, right? But like in the old days, what blockbuster movies would be something like Star Wars. At the time, I think everybody, I mean, my memory is a little bit, maybe a little bit cloudy because I was a little bit young when Star Wars was in the theaters originally. Yeah. But I feel like they've already unlocked the secret to what makes a good movie, and then they forget it each time trying to chase the kind of content everybody happy instead of picking a small subset of the movie going audience and milking them for all that it's worth.
Well, I think one of the other things too is that movies have gotten so much larger and larger budget.
Yeah.
So they're inherently, there's a lot more riding on any movie, and you need to be a lot more successful for any given movie, right? There isn't the same sort of volume of like mid-budget stuff anymore. So I think, you know,
I don't really have a sense of that. I mean, I could say that, but I don't really follow enough movies to get a sense in their budgets and stuff.
What I was looking at, but I was looking at people talking about like sort of how movies, and it's not that there's no space for them, but it's if you look at sort of like the big studios, there's a lot of like tentpole releases, and it's the same with video games where the budgets have just absolutely ballooned. And so the problem is that the bigger budget something is, the less weird you can make it, right? You need it to be mainstream. And so you have to, I think the more money you put into something, the more you can do, theoretically, but also the more that you are constrained by sort of those practical budgetary considerations of how do you actually make your money back. And you end up sanding off a lot of edges because you want safe bets. And it's not that a mid-budget movie can't go massively successful, because they totally can, but it's that you need more of a sure thing, right? The more money you put into something, the more confident you want to be that you're going to get your money back. So
again, this is just as an outside observer, but I think part of it is that the streaming has cannibalized a huge amount of the money that's made, right? So when you let somebody else take over what you do, like before, there was a time where... all right, so originally movies, they didn't get home releases. You'd only see them in theaters. They get re-released every once in a while. They make more money.
Yeah.
Then you started having home videos and video rentals and then DVDs and Blu-rays. And that was another source of income that was not originally planned for before this home media stuff came out. And now with streaming, they're outsourcing really a lot of the distribution, I guess, except, I mean, some of them are trying to take it back, right?
Yeah.
But when you look at Netflix is not, I mean, they're becoming more of a studio, but originally they weren't, you know, making a lot of content, right?
Yeah.
So when you let somebody else monetize your that stream, like the post-theatrical stream,
yeah,
and then they now have the control over how much money you make and basically are determine what the licensing fees are, and you have to come to an agreement. They can play it as much as you want, and then you lose out on that big money. And you see it now because physical media mm-hmm. is becoming so unpopular. I think Best Buy has stopped carrying it.
Wow.
And I mean, we saw this at Costco and Sam's Club when we went, where they used to have like a whole couple of aisles yeah. of combined books and visual media, like Blu-rays, DVDs and stuff. Mm-hmm. And now you might see like part of one aisle during Christmas season only, when mm-hmm. people are giving stuff away. There's hardly any kind of physical media for movies or TV shows anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the subscription model stuff, it hasn't been great, has it?
Not for the creators. I'm sure it's been great for the people who have set up the subscription model stuff. Like, you hear about that in Spotify where, yeah. you know, they're pulling the money out of something, and they're giving it to, you know, podcasters and stuff. I guess Joe yeah. Rogan, I'm thinking,
made so much money.
Right. But what does that mean for the people? I mean, it gives you exposure to independent artists who otherwise wouldn't have gotten it. So there's at least a potential there. But mm-hmm. I think a lot of, and the big stars, I think, still make their money.
Yeah.
The smaller stars, or the smaller content creators, I should say, the middlemen, like, this is what happens, right? They all get squeezed out. So whatever industry, as it gets consolidated,
mm-hmm.
you know, books became like, I guess, five big publishers. They push and push more for the big winners. And they're happy to get new writers, hoping to find the next big winner again.
Yeah.
But then the mid-list authors, who maybe have a few reasonably successful books.
They're very disposable.
Right.
Yeah.
Which is unfortunate and sad.
And there's sort of one extra dimension when you look at sort of streamers and tech-based stuff, which is sort of that startup economy and the idea of capturing sort of market share and venture capital and external funding, which changes the math a lot. Because I think theoretically, you're right, somebody's got to be getting value out of the process, right? Because that's just how businesses work. But the interesting thing is that, you know, you talk about looking for the big hit, sort of on top of everything that we've just talked about, there are like venture capital firms and private mm-hmm. equity organizations and all of this stuff that are essentially doing that same game as us, except on the company level, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where what you really want is you want to put money into something that is going to grow exponentially and your mm-hmm. investment in it is going to be worth a lot. And so how those funding cycles often work is, you know, they give you a certain amount of money. And you are expected to spend that money, right? It's not like, oh, you know, you made a good job. It was a good pitch. Now, you know, that's your sort of payout to the company or to the person who owns the company or whatever. They go, okay, so you're going to have this money and you are going to burn it, basically. Right. And you are going to spend it on sort of increasing the value of your product. You are going to do it. But one of the main things that you're doing ultimately is increasing either your retention rate or your market share. So you are just trying to get it in front of more people. And so you end up with, you know, you get $30 million and you don't use $30 million to turn yourself into a profitable business. You use it to sort of
improve
launch yourself.
Yeah, you're making your brand better.
Yeah, you use it to make yourself a really big business. And that money actually lets a lot of these companies not turn a profit. So it lets you just burn money, and it's not actually profitable for anybody, right? You know, the theoretical payout, it happens when you IPO, which is when you go public and you sell your stock.
So initial public offering, yeah. IPO.
Or when you get bought by somebody, right? And you right. get acquired. Or when...
Which is basically the same thing. IPO means that you're just selling to a lot of different people.
Yeah.
And getting bought out means that you're being sold to one big...
It's still person. A PO. It's just a private offering.
Right.
Yeah. Or the sort of... third thing, which is one day in the future, you sort of become a profitable business.
Right.
The first year that Uber was profitable was last year, 2023.
So you think I'm surprised that it's even profitable.
Yeah. But it's the first year that they had a higher net, right? Like if you look at sort of their books over time, right? They've never sort of made back the money that they've spent, right? So it's not like, you know, the way that a person would consider themselves their own finances, right? If I'm operating at a $5,000 deficit every year for 10 years, and then one year I make like you know, $900 more than I spend. I'm still, you know, I've still got all my debts from all the previous years. But, you know, Uber just kept getting cash infusions, right? And it grew. And so the point wasn't ever being profitable. Well, it's not wasn't ever, but for a long time, the point wasn't being profitable. Being profitable was like a tertiary goal way in the future. The point now was to grow and to grow huge. Right. And so that's the interesting thing about streaming is I think, you know, Netflix was a media company that was being run. It was a media company and a tech company, but it was being financed and all this other stuff like a tech company. So I think one of the things that ended up happening with, you know, the way that everything was fragmented and everybody tried to go to streaming and it seems to have sort of mixed results for people. And now as a consumer, you're not really getting what you want out of it, right? Because you have all these streaming platforms and it's only mildly better. The only real advantage is that you can binge stuff now. Everything is on demand, basically. Right. And that's the main difference because now you just have all these subscriptions, you're basically just paying for digital cable, right?
Yes.
And so the interesting thing is that even for all of that, you know, it didn't have to be profitable for anybody first. It just needed to be something speculatively worth betting on, right? Mm-hmm. And so these companies that are, you know, they're doing the exact same thing, which is they're betting on a bunch of people and they're hoping that one pays off big. So if you, you know that only 1 in 10 of your companies are going to be successful and most of them are going to fail, then that one that is successful needs to at least 10x your investment. And that's there's that sort of level where you talked about with authors, right? Where they're willing to bet on new people, churn through and then hope for that viral hit. It's working the exact same on a business level. And the problem is that, you know, for authors at least, the success metric is, you know, a lot of people reading it and liking it, right?
Right.
And for tech companies and that kind of thing, a lot of people do need to use it. It needs to be in front of a lot of people, but they don't really need to like it, right? With a book, nobody's going to go, oh, well, I don't really like this book anymore. And it doesn't really add, or this author anymore. And they don't really add much to my life. But, you know, they're so tied into sort of my day-to-day functioning that I have to keep buying all of their new books and I have to stay on that plan.
Well, it's funny too, right? I mean, the underlying principle that they pursue is the same, but because it's a different kind of, in different industries, there's different factors at play. So when you talk about something like tech, you're working with something like a much bigger audience. We're talking about individual books. A lot of people don't read for pleasure.
Yeah.
So there's at least the potential for less of the zero-sum game where people are competing against somebody else to try to pull them away. Because I'll tell you what, when more people like to read, they will read more. Mm-hmm. I could be reading more. I'm finally getting around to reading. Oh, The Expanse, if you've seen the show, the books are amazing. I'm finally I've read all 8 books plus the short stories. I'm finally getting around after buying the last book in the series, I think, 3.5 years ago, 3 years ago, maybe 3 years ago. And I'm really enjoying it, but it just, there's not enough readers.
Yeah, I gotta give those a read because I read the first couple. I remember the thing that I really, really liked about The Expanse was how many different kinds of stories it ended up being.
Yeah.
It was the scope of it. You know, it's a space opera.
Yeah.
But the fact that the scope of it sort of shifted and changed with each book and sort of the characters and the point of view and... Yeah. And I really enjoyed the sort of versatility of it. I mean, if you liked the start, there was the same stuff to like about it.
Yeah.
But that it ended up being a lot of different things. Because the first one was like, there was like a noir sort of detective element to it.
Yeah.
And it became something very, very different. I only read this first 3 or something like that. But
and we met them. We met Daniel Abraham and Ty Frank.
Yeah.
Interesting guys. Fun. Nice.
Yeah.
So we should do some. We're almost out of time. We should do some injustice questions.
Yeah. Let's do one. So Christopher Portillo 965 says hello. Or sorry, they say hey. Actually, they're a little more casual. They say hey. My account was suspended for no reason. Is there any way I can get it back? Or if I create a new account, how can I recover all my money and all my characters?
Suspended for no reason. That's not the question. I'll tell you what. There was a reason. It's a reason maybe that's not transparent to you.
Yeah.
The problem is sometimes. It's impossible to answer this question because we cannot know enough about what you've done or not done. And people are often very evasive in public about what they have done.
Yeah.
So this kind of detective work is pretty much impossible, not worth the effort.
If you've really done nothing, you can ask Warner Brothers support. It seems like they haven't really been unbanning people from our understanding for a while.
Right. So that's the second the second part, which is the real question. I think most of the time, the bottom line is it's unlikely, you're unlikely to be able to get your account back because Warner Brothers is, tends to be unresponsive. Because it, you know what it's like? It's like when the Supreme Court refuses to take a case and they don't have to give you the reason why, they just refuse it.
Yeah.
So they, you may not ever find out what was the trigger for banning your account. It could be something legitimate or it could be something not legitimate. People used to get, when Red Sun Green Lantern, I like to tell the story over and over again, but when Red Sun Green Lantern had his first challenge, people were banned
for playing with him. Yeah.
Playing with him online on iOS. And we presumed at the time, and we've never heard anything to disabuse ourselves of the notion, it's that they were banned because they'd set up the software to automatically ban people who had characters they weren't supposed to have, and they forgot to update it after his challenge ran.
Yeah. So, honestly, unfortunately, your best bet is to just start fresh, or if you really want all your sort of stuff the way that it used to be, is to find somebody in contravention of Warner Brothers terms and services who's like selling you an account or, you know, packing an account for you or whatever. So the best way to get stuff, unfortunately, is to either earn it yourself or find somewhere else to get it.
It really isn't earning it. The only way to get it back really is asking Warner Brothers. And the likelihood of that happening is so small to not really be a consideration.
Yeah. So you're in a little bit of an unfortunate spot.
In what we officially call a bind.
We are very sorry to hear that, though. Yeah. It's not fun, right?
It's frustrating. It is absolutely, especially when you put a lot of time in game. I mean, we've got separate accounts where we put years of our insignificant lives into it. But you know what? It's still meaningful to us. It's still significant to us. And so it would hurt immeasurably if we got any of those accounts banned.
And the stuff that sucks is, you don't necessarily understand why you got your account suspended, and you don't really have anything you can do about it. There's not a lot of recourse.
Right. As I've gotten older, I've appreciated more when you've had some sort of judgment against you, that there's a well laid out avenue for appealing it. And I've also come to appreciate more transparency when there's a process involved, you're not involved in, but at least you get to know what's happening so you can participate more fully.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So there we go. And on that maybe a little bit unfortunate note, I think this is bringing us to the end of this week. So to finish up, I would like to give a huge thank you to our patrons on Patreon. That is Michael DeVries, Irvin Ruiz, Hoshi127, and Nora Klimek on the credited level, as well as 5x5 on the gratitude tier. And we'd also like to give a huge thank you to everybody who's sat down and hung out with us for 32, almost 33 minutes. That's pretty cool.
You like counting the minutes lately.
Yeah, I think that's fun. I think it's... Okay, so it's going to be an extra minute now, but I recently sort of released that video like I talked about, and it got like 20-something, less than 30 views.
Right.
But each of those views means a lot more to me, right? There's sort of... It can be easy to forget, and especially when we've been doing it for a while, and we're not growing as a channel, it can be very easy to go, oh yeah, whatever, it's just the number of views that it is, and take it for granted. And so it's nice to anchor yourself in something that feels real and concrete. And so if anybody's right here, right now, you've hung out with us for more than half an hour. That's cool. That means something to me. That's a number that I can sit with. And if you've gone to this point and you'd like to drop a hello and let us know you made it to the end, I'd love to hear that. Be happy to hear from you. That would be a cool thing that you could do that would allow us to mutually appreciate each other. You like us enough to sit here and hang out with us, and we appreciate that you made it through, you know?
That's nice.
Yeah. Perfect, so anyways, thank you so much. We'll see you next time.
Komoda.